This Week in Free Energy.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. This is your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net and view our upcoming and archives of past shows. Today, our guest is Bruce Osborne. He is the CEO of Sterling Energy Systems, which they're developing equipment for utility-scale renewable energy power plants and distributed electrical generation systems. They actually had President George Bush visit their facility to announce his energy bill on August 8, 2005. Since then, the company has been continuing to develop their systems, and we are here to talk to Bruce. Thanks for joining us, Bruce.
Thank you, Sterling. It's a pleasure to speak with you again. And with a name like yours and the name as our, with our company at Sterling, I think it's a natural for this discussion.
Well, great. My spelling is actually a little different. It's S-T-E, but yeah, the Sterling engine is technology that's been around since when?
Well, good question, Sterling. The Sterling engine, the Sterling cycle, has actually been around for about 200 years. It's named after a Scottish minister named Robert Sterling, which is spelled S-T-I, a little different than yours.
And your system uses a Stirling engine at the focal point of a parabolic type system, and then generates electricity using the turbine actions generated from that heat. And where are you in the process of implementation of this technology?
Oh, thank you, Sterling. We're in our commercialization phase right now. Our exciting and innovative technology has been in work for the last decade. We've been quietly perfecting that in the research and development portion of it. We're now in what we call the second D&R, D&D, research and development. We have the deployment and the commercialization of that product, which includes a parabolic dish, as you indicated, and a power conversion unit that's at the focal point of where all the energy is focused, includes a Sterling engine. And so we're going through the commercialization, taking that product and making it ready for high-volume manufacturing. And then we're also, in parallel, working on two large-scale projects, one for Southern California Edison, the other for San Diego Gas and the Electric. And these two projects, each by themselves, would be the world's largest solar projects, but in combined, in total output would be nearly 2 gigawatts in power.
Wow. When will that gigawatt be deployed or fully operational?
Yeah, we're right now we've got probably another year and a half on our commercialization process. So we're looking at the end of 2008, early part of 2009 to start deploying the dishes.
When you say start deploying, you mean to start putting them in place or to turn on the switch and actually have them generating electricity?
Yeah, good question, Sterling. It's actually both, and it turns out one of the nice features of our system is that they're modular, so you can actually put the individual dishes in as they're ready, put them on into the ground, if you will, go through a checkout, get them operating, they actually produce electricity, and as they come on or as they're producing electricity, each individual dish, you can then put the remaining dishes on. So we can put in single dish, several dishes per day, and each day put additional dishes online, generating more green electricity for Southern California.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know there are quite a few people, and I have to include myself, who would not include President Bush as one that they would look at as a positive endorsement. Nevertheless, that is quite an accomplishment that he would choose your facility there at Sandia National Laboratories, where you had some of your test apparatus installed. that the administration chose your system as a backdrop when he announced his energy policy back in 2005. May I ask you what you think of that and how that has affected your business?
Yeah, I think it was very exciting for us, the folks at Sandia as well, and quite an honor to have President Bush and Energy Secretary Bodman come out. It turns out part of the reason is that the energy bill of 2005 was co-authored by the senators there in New Mexico. I am Senator Domenici. Was the lead on that, and so it was great. And quite interestingly enough, very interested in the technology and renewables, and he has some rather good questions as well about how the technology works. And with all the energy coming in at one end of our power conversion unit, was asking questions, well, gee, you must have to reject the heat somewhere, et cetera. So there are a lot of good questions about that as well. And I think overall the energy bill is good. It was pretty well balanced for all power, and as he indicated, it's more than just about power. It's really, it's an economic as well, and how do we get all energy moving forward. So we feel very good about that.
What is your cents per kilowatt hour bottom line? And I guess, you know, you have to talk about economies of scale, whatnot, and when you talk about a 2-gigawatt plant, you're obviously getting into an economy of scale. Can you talk about what your how your cents per kilowatt hour might compare to, say, a coal or a gas plant?
Yeah, cost is an interesting aspect of our systems here. One of the reasons I think the utilities have selected us is because not only has the technology been well proven over the last decade that we've been quietly perfecting it in terms of the hours of operation, et cetera, but also the potential for low cost. And with the nearly 2 gigawatts of power, as you indicate, we do have some definite benefits for economies of scale with that. And unfortunately, we're under non-disclosure agreements on the two contracts, Sterling, and can't really quote what the cost is on a cents per kilowatt basis. But it can maybe help you and some of the listeners on that. What our customers are telling us is that we are already below the market price reference, which would be the cost for a new gas-powered plant, if you will. And we're already below peak cost on similar type systems, which would be at 11 cents per kilowatt hour. So we're well below that. And we've also been told through a variety of sources that we're somewhere between a half and a third the cost of other solar power facilities.
And when you talk about being below the cost of a new gas plant, for example, obviously, you have an advantage over them. Not only is the initial capitalization lower, but there's not an ongoing fuel consumption. The sun is free.
Yeah, that's right. And let me be clarify that just a little bit. We're less in terms of the cost of energy that's produced. So that does include the initial capital cost as well as the ongoing energy price. And you're right, because our fuel is free. From the sun, we don't have that ongoing cost. So it's the combination of the two that makes us be lower. There's no attendant pollution, et cetera, with that as well. If you take the two large facilities that we're building for Southern California Edison and San Diego Gas and Electric, on an annualized basis, we'll be displacing more than 4 million tons of CO2 greenhouse gases, which is quite amazing.
Per year, you said?
Yes, per year. Yeah, 4 million tons of CO2 greenhouse gases per year.
Now, when we talk about solar, obviously one of the downsides of solar is that the sun is only on during the day, and when you have a cloudy day, you also have a diminishment of the output. What is your, do you have any storage plans, or is it going to just be integrated with the rest of the grid production and You know, what can you do, for example, to estimate output? Do you have to go on weather reports, or you know, let's talk about the reliability of solar in your scenario. Of course, Southern California is going to be more sunny than most places in North America.
Yeah, good, excellent question, Sterling. We get this a fair amount, and what we've done is selected areas where the annual solar generation potential is high. So in Southern California, for example, they have some of the best solar in the world. We get, you know, something on the order of 330 to 340 sunny days per year. One of the other nice things about the Sterling energy system is that we use a parabolic dish, as you indicated, that has a two-axis tracker. We follow the sun through the day, so actually, even as the sun is in the morning and into the midday and the evening, we have fairly significant output throughout the day. It's not like a flat plate solar collector or PV that you get the cosine effects of the sun during the day, so we actually have pretty good output throughout the day. But the energy that's required by the utilities throughout the day is pretty much during the hot part of the day. So when we produce peak power during the midday and early afternoons, that's when the utilities need it. Obviously, people are wanting to run their air conditioners, their lights, and their computers during the day. And as you go forward, the need is increased. The demand that the utilities are forecasting is primarily for peak power during the day. So right now, not having storage, not having electrical storage, et cetera, we don't see that as a negative. Southern California Edison, for example, has predicted that this summer, next summer, they're going to need another 2 gigawatts of additional peak power. They're not worried about base power, they're worried about peak power, and we fit that very well. So for the next decade or so, we don't see that as much of an issue. During that time period, electrical storage technology and methodologies will be improving and the cost will be coming down, and when that's there and the need arises, we'll be ready for it.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, Southern California Edison and San Diego Power are going to have other systems on board, or do have now. How much of their portfolio will your solar dishes comprise, so that as you're, you know, when you do have of the 340 days per year, 330 days per year, the remaining of those that are cloudy or portions of those days that are cloudy, they obviously are going to have other sources to draw from. How does that work, and how much of their portfolio do you comprise?
Yeah, another good question, Sterling. Both utilities have a mixed portfolio of conventional power as well as renewables. And you're right, it's not just our solar power, but it could be other solar power that would be, you know, off during inclement weather. But the other thing you have to remember is typically during inclement days, the heat load is down. You don't have the need for the air conditioners during that time period. So that's the primary driver. You know, the other power that's out there, obviously you can look at wind power, and that they actually pick up during the late afternoon and evening, so they're there to fill in. There's geothermal during the day, biomass, et cetera, and conventional power. In terms of percent load, I don't have precise numbers, but my understanding is that the Sterling system is on the order of 1 to 2% of Southern California Edison. And for San Diego Gas Electric, it's a little bit more in terms of total. I understand we're up to maybe 10% of their total load.
All right. And when you we were talking earlier about the process of implementation, and that by the end of 2008, beginning of 2009, you would be up and running. Obviously, it's going to take time to build those, and I'm just wondering if you could give us an idea of the production, I guess, timeline of when do you start cranking these things out, and how fast do you crank them out once you're cranking them out?
That's Sterling, the current plan is during the next year and a half to 2 years, we'll be completing our commercialization, and that takes our basic design and, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, transforms it into a product that can be built in high volume manufacturing, sites using, systems and processes and optimizations for that. You know, much like an automobile where you go from a hand-built unit to something that you build in the factory. And then what we're also working on now is how we'll be doing the assembly test and checkout there out in the desert before bringing them online. And our current strategic partners that we're working on, we believe that we can build 300-plus megawatts per year, which would be about 12,000 systems per year. And in terms of building it, we'll be ramping up in the late 2008 and early part of 2009, starting with lesser megawatts and ramping up to the 300 megawatts and beyond per year.
Mm-hmm. So with the 2 gigawatt requirement of the two utilities, it'll take you about, 6,
if you're doing the math,
years.
I'll help you on that one. Yeah, if you're doing the math, that's starting. We believe it'll take us somewhere in the 4 to 5 years to build that out. And so starting in 2009, we'll be going into the 9, 10, 11, 12, and then some of the expansions on those into the years beyond that. And we're also currently working on some other power purchase agreements, other contracts that would fill in behind that. What's nice is that these things are modular. So, as Henry Ford figured out a century ago, if you go from the hand-built to the high-volume manufacturing in the factory, it's just a matter of adding additional machines in the factory and some additional folks to help do that. And if we have more contracts and need to go at a higher rate, it's very easy to do that. The company that we're working with, Chef Steel, for working on the fabrication on our dishes, and Littemar, who's working with us on the power conversion unit, the Sterling engine, have capacities to do well beyond what we're talking about here. What we're looking at from a limitation is more the field installation and assembly efforts there. And again, that's just a matter of putting more crews out in the desert regions to do the assembly.
Obviously, the two utilities in California they're talking about are just a drop in the bucket in terms of world energy market and the market penetration. And of course, yours is not the only solar technology that is in the ballpark of what you're talking about in terms of getting to a point where they're cost competitive with conventional utilities. We track several, and yours has been in our top 100 energy technologies listing since the beginning, but there are other solar technologies that likewise are doing very well in terms of bringing the price point down and being feasible, as you're describing here. So it's not like you have a monopoly on eventual energy generation, but you obviously do have a niche. And I'm just wondering, how is your door wide open right now for new inquiries about new contracts for installation, or are you wanting to kind of play conservative until you can actually prove in the field that this thing works as advertised? And you've already done that with some prototypes.
Yeah, that's correct, Sterling. I think it's somewhere in between. Our plate is plenty full right now with working on the two large-scale contracts that we have. And our intent is to focus on those, get through the commercialization, and then what we're also doing is being selective about taking on additional projects. The Harvard Business case studies are full of companies that have tried to grow too quickly and try to take on everything and just weren't able to execute. And so what we're doing is just being very focused, a lot of focus and intensity around our commercialization and developing the existing projects that we have. But we are in discussions with other large-scale utilities for large projects. And if it makes sense, we'll sign them and add those to what we have right now, but do them on a non-interference basis with the schedule that we have right now. So that's basically how we're approaching in the southwestern part of the U.S. And then from a global standpoint, there's been a tremendous interest in it. and we see ourselves moving into that market, but again, waiting till we've gotten a good foothold with what we already have signed.
Now, let's just, and we may be getting into an NDA area again here, but with this question, but in terms of the growth curve and, you know, gauging between growing too fast versus going too slow, you talked about beginning with a 300 megawatt per year production capability. Where would you see that in 5 years from now?
Well, we've done some projections, and you know, you can draw kind of any curve you want, Sterling. So it's a little hard to predict, but I would say conservatively we're looking at that for our business model. But we show business models that have 2 to 3 times that as well. Partly doing the work ourselves, but we've got some partners that would like to expand, and we've had a number of folks approach us with joint ventures for expanding that. In terms of cost, yes, there's plenty of room for us to continue to reduce our cost. Obviously, you get the economies of scale, more automation, et cetera, associated with that. And, you know, as you get to other parts of the world, there's some labor advantages as well, but we see ourselves partnering with folks that are already in the different regions there. So a little hard to have a crystal ball out that far to predict precisely.
Now, one of the limiting factors with this particular modality is you need to have a fair amount of sun exposure. You're not going to be installing these in Canada anytime soon. But what percentage of the land-based mass on the planet would you say is well-suited toward this type of technology?
That depends, again. Right now, what we're focusing on are the more arid regions of the world that are near population. So, again, Southern California, the southwestern part of the U.S. are ideal. Many of the regions that are populated are good for that because people prefer to live in those regions. So I think it works well there. As we go farther north and south in latitude, you're right, there's a little less sun availability. But as the cost comes down on these systems, it then becomes more economically feasible to move into those, you know, lower solar regions. The other nice thing about our system, as I mentioned a bit earlier, is because of the two-axis tracking system, it's actually the most efficient collection system out there. Where we're taking advantage of the sun, even if it's lower in the horizon, we're able to still get pretty good concentrations with the solar energy to power our Stirling engine. It also has another nice feature besides producing being the world's most efficient solar conversion system in terms of taking sunlight in to grid quality electricity out. And we're about a factor two better than the nearest system. The other advantage it has is its part load efficiency, meaning when the sun's not as bright or as intense, efficiency in the output of the power is still very high. And if we also get into lower sun regions, we can readily add additional mirrors to our parabolic concentrator to make up for the reduction in solar insulation by adding very little cost to the overall system. So we see ourselves, again, focusing in the regions right now, southwestern part of the U.S., other regions like that. But as we get our costs down, it allows us to move further north in latitude and be cost effective for that. And that would be something we could see ourselves moving into in the coming years.
When you say the most efficient collection system out there, what numbers are we talking about in converting the sun's incoming energy to electrical output?
We've through third-party independent verification by both Southern California Edison and Sandia National Laboratories, which is part of the Department of Energy Sun Labs, which also includes the National Renewable Energy Lab, they have independently tested the various types of solar generation out there, which includes other concentrating solar power, which some people may be familiar with, parabolic trough, power tower, and a wide variety of photovoltaic systems, flat plate, two-axis tracking, and some of the concentrating PV that's coming out there. And we have peak efficiencies that are right around 30%. We've officially have the world's record at 29.4% sunlight in to grid quality electricity out, and we have unofficially broken the record many times with our current generation at in the low 30s. On an annual basis, we're probably in the low to mid 20s overall, where most other systems are below 10% to maybe the low teens. So in general, we're a factor of 2 to 3 more efficient than the other solar technologies. And that's part of our cost advantage here. If you think about it, you have a 500 megawatt solar plant, and one system has twice the efficiency of another solar technology. That means we need about half the raw materials, the glass and steel, et cetera, required for the other competing system. And if you'll pardon the oversimplification, raw materials in and a transformation cost. If you have half the raw materials, raw material costs, you've got about half the cost. And the second advantage we have is the modularity that we talked about earlier that allows us to put it in a factory and use high-volume manufacturing techniques to get the cost down. So it's a combination of the efficiency and the modularity that allows us to have these very attractive unit costs. And then when you look at the modularity, that also gives us some other advantages in terms of fielding it. One we talked about previously, that as you build a unit, you can put it in the ground, get it on sun, generating revenue right away. You don't have to wait for 3, 4, 5 years to get the full plant built out. You're actually generating revenue. And that same modularity gives us some nice advantages from an availability. You talked about reliability being important to the utilities with the sun, but the availability is an important aspect too. We don't have single point failures. If one dish system's down, or 10 or even 100, when we're putting in thousands or tens of thousands of these systems, we've got high availability for the overall plant output. Other nice features on the system besides that is low water usage. If you're in arid regions and water's becoming a real premium for the world, these systems use less than 1% of some of the other concentrating solar power systems out there, and that's a big deal. I think most folks don't realize, in fact, I didn't fully realize until President Bush was giving the part of the speech for the energy bill that he mentioned in 2005, that 40% of the water usage in the U.S. is used for electrical power generation. I went and verified that statistic, and it turns out it's true. And so we use just a small fraction of what other solar thermal generating systems require. And that's
because I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, that's because of the Stirling engine. It's quite a remarkable, we kind of skipped over it at the beginning, but it's quite a remarkable system. It has the highest theoretical efficiency given a temperature that you're working with, so the hot side and the cold side in terms of output power. And that's what's, again, what's unique about our system is we've taken the most efficient solar collector, two-axis tracking parabolic, that takes all that energy, and it's like a very large reflective magnifying glass. As a kid, you used to burn, at least I did as a kid, used to burn paper and leaves and bugs and stuff like that. And that's what this is. It's just a very sophisticated reflective magnifying glass that takes all that
And I
energy.
Ate them, too.
Pardon me?
I'd cook them, then I eat them.
Okay. But you can use that to take that fierce heat then and use it to drive the Stirling engine. And the Stirling engine is a just a closed cycle heat engine that you can take that external heat to heat the gas. And when you heat the gas, it expands to push a piston to turn a crankshaft that turns a generator to make electricity. So combining the best collector with the best heat engine gives us this very high performance that we have. So it's a very simple, elegant, and efficient system overall.
Where do the patents come in since you're using normally off-the-shelf components?
Yeah, good question. The Stirling cycle and thermodynamic cycles in general, you can't patent, and they've been around for a couple hundred years, so any patents that might have been on them were gone. We've been working with Kokam's, formerly United Stirling, and licensing some of their technology. But these days, it's not so much in the patents. The intellectual property is more trade secrets, kind of like Coke has the recipe that they don't advertise so people can't duplicate it. That's what we've done is we have a few key parts of the Stirling engine that allow ours to run efficiently and reliably with good life. and it's been demonstrated, as I mentioned, over the last 1 to 2 decades. And then another area is the controls. We have 3 different control systems on this, one for the power conversion unit, one for the dish collector as it tracks the sun, and then we have another one that operates the overall plant. And over the years, what we've done is learned a lot and put in a lot of sophistication there to optimize the output of our systems to reduce costs and make sure that we have the high reliability and the high performance out of these systems. So it's there. There are some other process type improvements that we've made in terms of how we make the mirrors, how we make the structure, you know, those types of things. Those are unique to us, and we think it's part of our competitive advantage.
Now, one time I was hearing about these parabolic trough-type mirrors, they have to wash those every day. That's a lot of water and a lot of time. Your mirrors would be getting dirty as well. What kind of maintenance is required on that end?
Yeah, that's you're asking a lot of very good questions here, Sterling, so thank you. This makes it enjoyable for me. We actually design the system so that we know that they'll be getting dust and dirt and stuff like that on them. And we've got a lot of history with these out in, you know, the Mojave Desert, out in the New Mexico and other desert regions. And we've designed them so that we can rinse the mirrors. Basically, it's just a high-pressure deionized or, you know, demineralized, actually, water system. It takes about 14 gallons, and we do that about every 3 to 4 weeks. And we actually optimize when we do the washings. We know that as they're starting to get dirty, the output power comes down. And when it gets to a certain level, it's cost-effective for us to go ahead and rinse the mirrors off. And so we don't need to wash them on a daily basis. We do it periodically. We actually have a small crew that goes through and washes dishes, if you will, or kind of much like you do window washing. But it's just basically hosing them off to get the worst of the soiling off. And then about once a year, we'll go through and do a manual scrub where they'll actually physically go up there and scrub the mirrors. And we've got a lot of experience with that. We know what the cost is, and we know how to optimize, you know, kind of that ongoing maintenance action. It turns out it's about 6% of the total cost of our ongoing operation and maintenance, so it's not a big part of it. When you look at the water usage, it's small. In fact, if we need less mirrors than, you know, other technologies that are not as efficient, if they're 2 to 3 times less efficient, they need 2 to 3 times more mirrors, so they'll actually need more for that. Or if you have a photovoltaic system, they themselves need to have be washed periodically. You can't just let them, you know, get covered with a lot of dirt and soiling because their overall performance and efficiency goes down. So it's not unique to our technology. It's the same for all, but again, because of our efficiency, we have less surface area that needs to be cleaned, and so we actually use less water than other solar technologies.
When you said earlier that you're using less than 1% of the water of other concentrated power systems, was that what you were referring to? Was the cleaning part of it, or was that the something intrinsic to the Stirling engine cycle?
It's really more intrinsic to the Stirling cycle. We have a closed loop system. We use a gas that we heat, and when you expand it, that's what provides the motive. As you did the introduction talking about turbines, we actually don't have a turbine in our system. Most conventional thermal generation, including other concentrating solar power systems, use solar thermal, and they use a steam turbine, and so it's actually part of the Rankine cycle. It's called steam cycle. They use water in that to generate steam to run a turbine. You expand it and get the the electrical. You drive a generator to get the electrical output on it. So it's really more related to that. Sterling was what I was thinking. But again, if you've got a system that's not quite as efficient, it means you need more collector areas. So just even on a mirror collection basis, there would be 2 to 3 times more water required than for our systems.
Uh-huh. Now, back to the Stirling engine cycle, that's an internal combustion engine as opposed to external, meaning that the it's a closed-loop system, isn't it? You don't have water going in and then steam coming out, but you've got – maybe you can explain that just briefly.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And it's really, it's not. We call it an external heat engine because you apply the energy external to the cycle as opposed to, as you mentioned, an internal combustion, an IC engine. And most people can think of their automobile or a diesel engines where you actually have the air and fuel mixture inside and you spark it to get a combustion internal. That's where the internal combustion is to drive it, and it's that internal combustion that causes the high heat and pressure to drive the piston that turns the crankshaft to turn a generator. In our system, we have a small four-cylinder, four-piston system that has a working gas. In the days of Robert Stirling, it was just air, and in more recent years, they use helium or hydrogen to be the gas. It's more efficient from a heat transfer and thermodynamic standpoint. And so what we do is we just have the gas that's in the engine, and it's fixed. That we don't burn it, we don't use it, we don't consume it. And when you heat a gas, it simply the pressure rises in it, which that high pressure then allows it to push the piston. And when you cool the gas, it contracts, which allows it to return. That's an oversimplification of the thermodynamic cycle. I could go through it, but just for the average listener, it's a very simple system where you heat the gas, it raises the pressure and expands, pushing the piston to do the drive the generator. And when you cool it, it returns and contracts. And we just, in a very sophisticated way, alternately heat and cool the gas to have it expand and contract to drive the engine system. So we're not burning the gas. There's no combustion. There's no emissions, no byproducts. There's no CO2 generated, which is what everyone's worried about with global warming. And as I mentioned, the statistic before, which is just staggering, we believe our systems are a good part of the global warming and environmental solution out there with displacing, you know, something on the order or in excess of 4 million tons of greenhouse gases per year.
Mm-hmm. One thing that we've not done in this segment is to describe the size of one of these modules. Let's go into that for a second.
Yeah, a lot of folks think these are small systems that they could put on their roof or put in their backyard, et cetera, and we actually refer to these as industrial strength solar. And if you were to kind of walk through, you know, this first power plant that we'll be putting in for Southern California Edison and the second one for San Diego Gas and Electric here in the next couple of years, these things are enormous. The dish systems themselves are about 40 feet high. The dish is about 37 to 38 feet in diameter. We have 82 mirrors comprised the parabolic system that you mentioned. So we have a pretty large collection area. And it has a sits on a pedestal, and it tracks the sun much like a sunflower tracks the sun during the day. So it has a two-axis tracking system. So in the morning, when the sun comes up, we know our latitude and longitude, the time of day, and from ephemeris data, we can very accurately predict where the sun is at any moment during the day. So we have open-loop tracking, and then we actually have a closed-loop tracking controller that allows us to very precisely align and focus that sun's energy to get maximum performance out of our system and to minimize the stresses and strains on the engine. And so the sun comes up, we wake up our systems, we focus on the sun, we track it through the day, through the afternoon, the late afternoon and evening till sunset, and then we reset it. We rest the systems during the night, if you will, and then they're ready to work the following day. So we produce about 25 kilowatts per system with this each system, and you take the power of one and multiply it by however many units you want. So for a 500 megawatt plant, for example, that would be 20,000 of these systems, and we require about 1 acre for 8 systems, or 1 megawatt would require about 5 acres, and so you do 5 times the 500 megawatts. We'd need about 2,500 acres for that, but we actually need some spacing and other stuff, so we'll do many times that for these large power plants. And so if you were to walk through it, it'd be kind of like walking through a forest of solar trees, if you will, that take the sunlight in and generate electricity, not unlike a conventional forest. Maybe it's not a good analogy here, Sterling, but it's a standard forest where the trees take in the solar energy and through photosynthesis convert it into energy for the plant. And we do the same thing. We take that solar energy with our solar trees, if you will, to track the sun and convert that into electricity for the average home.
The diameter, 37-inch diameter, how far out is the focal point where the Stirling engine sits?
Yeah, it's actually 37 feet, not 37 inches, so pretty good size.
Yeah.
A couple stories, two, three stories tall, kind of like that. And the focal point's out, I don't remember exactly, but it's something on the order of 20 feet out. And so at the focal point, we have the power conversion unit, and what's there is the receiver that takes this highly concentrated solar energy, and that the energy there at that focal point is very high. We run it at 720 degrees Celsius, which is about 1,350 degrees Fahrenheit, so it glows white hot. If we did not take the heat out of it, it would get much hotter, and you could melt aluminum, melt steel, melt in canal. You can actually melt some ceramic materials with that intense heat. But what we do is, in a very sophisticated way, take that to run the Stirling engine and actually control the heater head temperature at the receiver. And then we take that heat, as I mentioned before, to run the Stirling engine to run a conventional generator that produces 25 kilowatts of 480 volt, three-phase, 60 hertz power that's ready to go onto the grid. And then we'll run through transformers to take it up to whatever voltage we need for the facility. Typically on these very large scales, we're running at 230 kV to 500 kV kilovolts there, but we can run anything between 480 and those.
Now, I'm just curious, with that kind of heat at that focal point, wind turbines have a problem with bird kills as the birds get whacked by the blades coming down on them. Some of those larger turbines approach the speed of sound at the tip of the blades are going so fast. I'm wondering if there's any ecological ramifications of that focal point as birds happen to fly through there and all of a sudden get blasted with some heat, or is it transient enough that they don't get bothered by it?
Yeah, great question. We get that asked a lot, and you're right. There's a lot of concern about avian kill with wind turbines, and so people are concerned about bird flying through and, kind of turkey getting cooked, if you will. Our experience to date is we're not aware of any bird kills with these systems, and we've had some systems running as long as 20 years, 22 years, in fact. And what we've observed is that if you're near the dish itself, the mirrors, the birds don't fly into it. People worry about them flying into the mirrors like you do on a building. Well, the mirrors are curved, so they aren't flat, so it doesn't look to the bird as if it's flying into the sky, the reflected sky. So we don't have that problem. We've been asked that. The other is flying into the beam. What we find is if you're near the mirrors, the concentration is low. It's not a problem at all. If you get to the focal point where it is fierce, a couple of things happen. If they're flying nearby, there's some thermals that actually would lift them above, so it actually is protective that way. The other thing is it's so bright, they actually avoid it, and as they get anywhere near it, they feel the radiated energy from it, the heat, and they actually avoid it. So it's, in a way, very much self-protective. The birds are aware enough just when they feel, they're getting anywhere near it, they feel the radiated energy, they actually go the opposite direction. So to our experience, nothing, and we have people out with these systems every day, and if you had a toasted bird, if I can say it that way, not to be flippant about it, but if you had a bird that had gone through it and was burnt or something, there would be evidence around to that, and we've not, our folks, the Sandia folks, and some of them, Dr. Tom Mancini that works out there is actually a very avid bird watcher, so we would know if we had some problem like that. So it's good. In fact, these systems are very benign. A lot of the environmentalists, et cetera, actually like our systems because we're low impact to the desert regions. We don't have to carve the land flat like you do for other solar systems, et cetera. We can just put in basically auger a hole, put in the post, and it's kind of like planting trees, to use that analogy again. So you don't have to disrupt large areas of the desert region We are collecting regions that are not what they call Duima Desert Wildlife Environmental Management Areas. We're staying away from those regions. They're remote. There aren't any, you know, residences or businesses out there, and it's also in areas that are more benign. We do, and we're currently going through massive biological and cultural studies for these regions, and so far the environmentalists and all the other folks that are looking at it actually have helped us select these regions because you know, they can support our technology. We talked about the water part. We use a fraction of other power generation systems, so folks like us for that. In terms of land area, we do use some pretty significant areas of land. I mean, we're talking, you know, thousands of acres, which seems like a lot to me and maybe to the average listener here, but when you look at the Southern California desert, we're talking fractions of a percentage. I mean, it's small. It's hardly even getting started in that region. So it's good from that standpoint. And again, if you compare it against other solar technologies that take more similar-sized wind farms that are out there, they have a footprint that's about three times what ours takes to get the same number of megawatts out. So, again, it's very environmentally friendly. No pollution, no corrosive or caustic heat transfer fluids like there are for others. And, again, no emissions, no combustion, no byproducts, anything like that.
So what about overall, comparing it to the footprint of a hydroelectric dam and the amount of water that is displacing what used to be dry ground? How would it compare to a hydroelectric system?
That's an interesting statistic that you're talking about, Sterling. We've done that. So, for example, our two large-scale power plants put out 1.75 gigawatts, nearly 2 gigawatts. That's just about the same amount of output for Hoover Dam that has Lake Mead behind it. And so we might use, you know, something on the order of 11, 12, or 13 square miles or sections of land. But if you compared it to Hoover Dam, it's about 250 square miles. So we're about one-twentieth, about 5% of the land mass behind it, as you put it, and about the same output power and about the same amount of electricity generated in a year, something on the order of 4 billion, if you can imagine, kilowatt hours per year. It's a tremendous amount of power that's being generated. And that's about, I don't know, something in excess of 1 million homes that we can power with these, similar to Hoover Dam. So we really are talking about utility scale or industrial strength, large-scale solar power here. This isn't
your
workshop.
Do you ever see yourself scaling it down for smaller, maybe a business or maybe even a larger home?
Yes, in fact, that's actually where we started, to be quite honest. When Sterling Energy Systems was founded about 11 years ago, we were actually looking at doing smaller solar, where we would do it for small communities, you know, residences, businesses, and things like that, where you take the power of one or, you know, 10 or maybe up to 100, and that was the original concept, and kind of work our way forward. Well, what we found, it was kind of this chicken and egg issue, and that's what makes me go back to the Henry Ford analogy, where this is a funny-shaped automobile. And, you know, we've got a small engine, like you do in, say, a Ford Focus, you know, a little four-cylinder engine, and the mirrors are nothing but back silvered glass. And when I worked at Ford in my early career, Ford made more glass than anybody in the world. And you just back silver that. Well, that's like automobile and you know, office building glass. And then the structure that we have on this is like the chassis of a car, that steel structure. And then you have wiring harnesses for controls and drive motors and electronics and stuff like that. And so what Henry Ford figured out a century ago is that when you hand-build automobiles, they're very expensive. But when you start putting in automation, doing high-volume manufacturing, you can do you can get the cost down going forward. And so our problem, taking it back, is when you build one, these hand-built units are, you know, $250,000 each. That's not very cost-effective. That's like $10 a watt, you know, not unlike what photovoltaic is. You know, they're in the $5 to $10 per watt in smaller systems. And so by going to these large-scale power plants, we can, you know, get our costs down by a factor of 5 to 10. and that makes it very attractive then on a large scale. And once we do that then, Sterling, that's exactly right. We can do these large plants that primes the manufacturing pump, if you will, and then would allow us to go to smaller, more distributed type opportunities. So it's all part of our strategic plan for getting started, working where it makes sense here in the southwestern part of the U.S., where there's a huge need for peak renewable power, and then as we get the cost down, we can move to other latitudes, as we talked about a little while ago, and we can also go to smaller systems and be cost effective.
Where is your first plant going to be, the manufacturing plant?
It's going to be distributed. What we're doing is we have SCS, which is a small company, but what we do is we've brought together a very sophisticated strategic partner, strategic alliances. We have over 100 companies that we're working with. We have several major ones that do major components, and they're located here in the U.S. We're a U.S.-based company, and we believe it makes sense to get started here in the southwestern part of the U.S. with companies that are here instead of shipping glass and steel and stuff throughout the world, here or vice versa. Go ahead and work with local U.S. Companies. So the manufacturing plants will be here in the States for the basic components, shipped to the sites. We'll do local assembly, test, check out, bring them online, do the ongoing operation and maintenance. The companies that we're partnering with, in most cases, are pretty good-sized companies, half a billion to several billion dollar a year revenues, and they have a global presence. So not only are they able to do things here in the U.S. and North America, but they have a presence throughout the U.S., which will allow us, when it's time to move to other regions, to work with companies that are already there and partner with the local industry there.
This is being capitalized by the two utilities you described?
Well, it's two different ways there. So another good question here, Sterling. The company itself, Sterling Energy Systems, to date has been privately funded. We're a private company. We have over 400 shareholders, and we're working with some institutional financing as well for our commercialization and project development activities we have. That's all the front-end work. When we get into the projects, we'll actually do project financing, because these projects are huge. I mean, we're talking billion-dollar type projects, and we'll be going out with the institutions that traditionally finance projects, and we're looking at a combination of equity and debt, and doing kind of a sale leaseback, if you will, structure to take advantage of the investment tax credits that are available for solar power systems. So it's actually a combination of financing structures to make this happen.
So being privately funded, somebody wants to invest in the company, they contact you and they, is that how that works?
Yeah, they can do that. We're not really, we started the company with angel funding, but we've kind of moved beyond that, and we're actually kind of in the middle range of financing for the company. So unfortunately, the individual investor, we're just not available to accommodate them any further. But someday in the not too distant future, and it's too early to predict exactly when that is, but we're anticipating that we'll become a public company, and so the average investor could then partake at that point. But yes, if they have interest, they can contact us through our website at sterlingenergy.com, and it's STI, unlike your name, Sterling, as we mentioned a few minutes ago, Sterling Energy, one word, and can contact us through that's probably the most effective way to do it.
Yeah, we are just about out of time, but I have one question I have to ask on the, we were talking about the Stirling focal point, where the Stirling engine sits, where the heat is going. Do you have something on the back end of that to supply the cool side, or do you just use ambient air?
Yes to both of those. What we have is on the cold side, good question, same question that President Bush asked back, actually. And what we do is on the cold side, what we do is run the radiator system much like your automobile. So we have regenerators, which are one of the key parts in a Stirling engine that allow us to preheat and take the waste heat out and store it, much like a thermal capacitor, if you will. And then we run it through gas coolers, which we cool the gas off with an ethylene glycol water mixture. And then we take that and run it through a radiator, again, much like your automobile, with a variable speed fan that rejects the heat into the ambient air. So we just take the outside air at whatever temperature, run it through the radiator to cool that side. So a very good question on your part, Sterling.
Well, I appreciate the time you spent here. We've been speaking with Bruce Osborne of Sterling Energy Systems. They have a large industrial-scale solar application, and their website, again, is sterlingenergy.com. That's spelled S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G-Engine.com. Thanks for joining us, Bruce. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you very much, Sterling, for giving us the opportunity to share our exciting and innovative solar technology with you and your listeners.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Bye now.
Bye.